Welcome, Parish Orphans and Retrogrades, to another exciting show. My name is Timothy Gordon. I am here with Joe Heschmeyer, a great apologist. You've heard him recently making the rounds about his new book, Pope Peter. It's a great book, and it's been especially relevant. It's always relevant, but it's especially relevant in a Francis pontificate, and it's even most especially relevant at this, 25th, 30th, 35th time in the Francis pontificate when Francis is back in hot water, if such a thing exists for popes. But Joe, it's great to have you with us. How are you today?
I'm doing great. I'm very grateful to be on the show, and it's definitely been an exciting time to talk about the papacy. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, by it has been an exciting time to talk about the papacy. You mean the last since 2013, spring of 2013, right?
Yeah, there's not like a lack of topics to cover and say, what did he mean when he said this? Or why did in the world did he say it that way? Or what does he mean? All of that stuff has been happening just on overdrive. But it seems like every time you think this isn't going to get more intense, it just ratchets up like another notch.
Yeah, to the point where like ratcheting up means you usually figure it's two steps forward, one step back. You're going up in tension. It's like, wow, I didn't know this is like a nuclear level of tension now, because it's just gotten ratcheted up every 3 weeks since March of 2013.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. So this is on Catholic Answers Press, Pope Peter defending the church's most distinctive doctrine in a time of crisis. I want you to tell us about it, because when I heard you on Psykelet a week and a half ago, you were defending the book, and of course it's a Catholic Answers program, defending a Catholic Answers publication, but you were focusing on Francis himself, and of course we're going to do that the latter part of this interview, but I want to hear about this argument, because you are, contrary to what some people are saying about Catholic Answers, or have been saying over the last 7 years, you're really, we talked some before, and you're really, really, really reasonable about the Francis issue, the Francis problem. So we're going to get to that in a second. Real fast, I would like to talk to the fellow retrogrades out there about just saying shirts, just saying. I'm wearing a shirt that says lock her up. You could probably guess who I'm talking about. Miss Hillary Clinton, the one and the only, lock her up. There are several quippy shirts that my buddy here at Just Saying Shirts has stuck onto the front of t-shirts, and wear them before or after the election with pride. It's a great store, Just Saying Clothing. This company sells shirts with comedic political catchphrases, not just lock her up, but basement Biden, no mask Nancy, Beijing Biden, crying Chuck. They're mainly Trumpisms, which is my favorite part, and much more. Please check it out. It's Just Saying Clothing. The link will be provided in the description to the show. A second quick plug is for my brother David Gordon, Dave's YouTube channel, The Church Domestic, which is up and going now. He had it up before, but we didn't really talk about it much. Dave is going to be focusing on different aspects, and some the same, of Rules for Retrogrades, particularly the ones as between husband and wife, the church domestic. That's really become his area of expertise, but he'll be uploading videos there. The church domestic, go to Dave's channel. Good stuff. You know, it's like a two Rules for Retrogrades channels, and he'll be coming on the show when, of course, we're plugging our new book, which doesn't have a title yet. We've been affectionately calling it No Christian Feminism. He'll be coming on when that's released in early February, and you'll see him from time to time before that, I'm sure. Joe Heschmeyer, tell us about Pope Peter. This is a important book for an important time.
Yeah, so the subtitle of the book is Defending the Church's Most Distinctive Doctrine in a Time of Crisis. So I want to pick apart maybe just that to say, okay, what's the book about just on the level of the title? First, the idea of the church's most distinctive doctrine is like this. Like, there's a lot of Catholic Protestant, Catholic Orthodox apologias that there's kind of the laundry list. There's like, well, oh, you know, we disagree on purgatory and on the saints and on Mary and on the Eucharist and on and on and on and on down the list, you know, justification, whatever you want to add on. And it can be totally overwhelming. And we were talking a little bit before the show that, like, really what we mean is that this is the specific difference. Like, if you want to know what makes man different than the animals, it's that man's a rational animal. So the difference between man and the animals is that man is rational. And likewise, the difference between Catholicism and every other form of Christianity is the papacy. If the papacy is true, everyone should be Catholic. If the papacy is false, nobody should be Catholic. And one of the great things about that is it makes the debate so much easier. Like, if you want to know if you should be Catholic or not, you don't have to solve every theological problem under the sun. And if, by the way, you don't even have the tools to solve every theological problem under the sun if you don't know if you can accept the magisterium, if you don't know if you can accept the papacy, if you don't know if you can accept church councils, etc. So, like, from the Protestant perspective, if you can't trust your own denomination to be infallible, if you can't trust that the answers you're getting in your parish are true, and you want to be an Orthodox believing follower of Christ, you have this crazy burden to solve every theological problem on your own that no one's ever been able to do. And so this is like, okay, well, that's obviously not what Christ is calling us to. It's obviously not what we see in the New Testament. Like, when the Ethiopian eunuch's reading Isaiah, and Philip's like, do you understand what you're reading? He's like, how can I, unless someone teaches me? Like, this idea that, like, we have to solve all of these problems on our own and then find the church that, like, best corresponds to our theological conclusions is impossible. It's insane. It's unworkable.
But so the Eastern Orthodox claim that we claim we can solve everything with scholastic philosophy. They claim we're the smarty pantses that got caught with our smarty pants down or something like that, you know? It's a little different responding to Eastern Orthodox than it is to the Protestants.
It is. So I actually have a section in the book where I look at that kind of briefly. That so on the Protestant side, you have, you know, this famous line that the Bible is a fallible collection of infallible books. Which is unworkable. You know, it's the idea that all the books of the Bible are inspired if we happen to have the right ones. Well, that doesn't mean, it's like saying all the answers on the test are inspired if I happen to get the right answers.
Right.
Like, that doesn't mean any, like, you've gotten rid of all the authority of the Bible in that. Well, the Orthodox parallel to that is, I quote Callistus Ware, the bishop, who says we don't know how many councils there are. Like, the ecumenical councils are infallible. We don't know how many there are. There might be seven, there might be nine. Different Orthodox disagree. And right now, like, if the Catholic Church is in hot water right now, like, this is a real, like, frying pan fire kind of situation, because the Orthodox are in the middle of what's probably the biggest schism in several hundred years, but amongst themselves. Like, the Ecumenical Patriarchate is not in communion with the Russian Orthodox,
right?
This is, like, two-thirds of the Orthodox believers are not in communion with the person ostensibly at the head of Orthodoxy.
I know, they literally can't get the 14 autocephalous churches together, and it's funny, some of their greatest mystics have said, we don't like Rome. I think it was Soloviev, who was a huge influence on Dostoevsky, he was like, we don't like Rome, but we have to admit that without Papa, you can't get the 14 brothers to the table. And we've seen that a lot the last 6 years, the Orthodox trying to get the 14 autocephalous churches together. They can't even call them together. So they do have problems.
Matthew 16, Fulton Sheen's commentary on it is so good. He just says the first question, Jesus says, who do men say that I am? And you get all these contradictory answers. That's Protestantism in a nutshell. Then when you have congregational level polity where the people decide, the people don't decide the same thing. And we have 500 years of evidence of that. But then the next question he says is, well, who do you, the 12, say that I am? And then when 11 of them are silent without Peter, that's Orthodoxy. That's, you know, the brothers aren't all coming to the table. Right. And so to have both the unity and the clarity, you do need Peter. Now, of course, having said this, let's get to the other half of the subtitle, in a time of crisis. This is how the papacy works in theory. This is why the papacy exists. But it would be crazy to say, oh, yeah, look at how clear and everything is right now. Look at how, you know, everything's so unified and crystal clear. Like, it, open the door. Look out the window. It's not like that right now. We're not living with the papacy operating as it ought to, I think, is a fair way to describe it. I would actually challenge anyone to disagree with that statement and explain why.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's the understanding. Okay, so in this current pontificate, number 266, things are less than perfectly clear or something. I think I heard, Cy Kellett did a good job interviewing you and plugging your book, but he said something like that at one point, and I was like, Cy, Come on, this is more than a lack of perfect clarity. This is weaponized ambiguity every day, sometimes every other month, spiking to fever pitch or something like that. But we'll talk about Francis in particularly in a little bit. But it was a great interview. Everyone I know listened to it when you went on and plugged Pope Peter on Psychelet, because it's interesting. Because if we can, let's just talk about Catholic Answers for a minute. I have lots of friends there too, but they have warranted for, you know, over 7 years, the reputation that they will never, it doesn't matter which Francis gaffe it is, that they will never, ever say anything. So everyone tuned into that show because it was like, this is, and the fact that they would publish your book at this point, this says a lot. Okay, where the tables have turned. Now they're willing to say there is a real problem here. It's not move along, folks, nothing to see anymore.
Yeah, so I don't know all the internal workings, right? But I know this. Like, there's a holy kind of filial respect that you pay to not needlessly uncover your father's nakedness, right? Like, you know, the Noah reference there.
I'm not
just being weird about my dad.
I got it. My dad's just not naked that much, right? I don't really know. If he was, I would just visit my parents less.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think we have a pontificate that spends a fair amount of time naked. You know, like, I really regret this choice of images, but
like 23 hours a day he is in the buff. Yeah.
So I think there is, like, we have a moral duty not to just leap to the worst conclusion, not to just say, like, I rebuke you, and not to call out needlessly things that don't have to be called out. Like, every pope has some level of lack of clarity or some level of error. And when I say error, I don't just mean like heresy. I mean, like, they say things in an opaque way, or they trip over their words or whatever. And we live in an era that really, like, love, you know, in politics and everything. It's like, oh, well, you said this in a really bad way. And then we get the great little clip, and then everybody laughs. That's not holy. That's not pious. That's not what we're called to for anyone. Pope. So there is a holy kind of restraint, but there are also times when a thing has to be kind of addressed. And so I think the civil unions thing that just happened, you have to say something about it. And if you don't, I think there's a real danger there that something even more important than the person of the Pope can be threatened, which is the purity and clarity of the teaching, which is what the Pope exists to serve in a real way. So if you're protecting the person of the Pope at the expense of the clarity of doctrine, I don't think you're doing the Church a favor. So I think I really admire the way Catholic Answers has shown restraint, but I also admire the fact that they're not just going to say, yeah, whatever he says, we'll just take it as, you know, take things at the best, you know, in the most charitable light. Don't pretend black is white or, you know, you see what I'm saying.
Yeah, of course. And I don't want to focus on Catholic Answers because you don't speak for them any more than I do because I've been on, or they were the original publisher of my first book. So I don't want to make you accountable in that way. But let's just give the proper amount of context to that interview you did with Saya Kellett. I mean, I'm just going to speak for myself here. I don't want to go out guns blazing. But the virtue, in this case, the intellectual virtue, is the golden mean, which is to say it is a geometrically proportioned middle, which means it's not the actual center middle, like Aristotle says about all the individual moral virtues. It's always halfway between a vice of excess, too much of that thing, and a vice of deficiency. But it's always closer to one or the other, and it's never the same one. It's not all, the virtue is not the middle that's kind of closer to excess or deficiency. It depends. When it comes to courage, it's closer to rashness than cowardice. When it comes to, I don't know, there's somewhere it's closer to the deficiency. We are not anymore in any possible universe, and we haven't been for years, where talking about Pope Francis is, you know, like, in a, I guess, a negative way, negative reportage, is scurrilous or fatuous, or one who reports his whatever malfeasance is his intentional bending of Christian teaching can be attributed to the reporter. I don't know of any of the, how many times has this come out? 50, 50 major reportings where I was like, oh, come on. It's just on this one, give the guy a break. Like, I'm getting the reputation as, even though I'm called trad, I'm like, no, that one's just not whatever. That's not a big deal. With Francis, that never happens. With Francis, a way I am more temperate than most of fellow trads is on Vatican II. I'm writing this book, and it's the research, Joe, has changed my outlook, which is supposed to occasionally happen. Sometimes you do research, and it confirms your bias. You have good confirmation bias vindicated. It's the opposite with the Magisterium of Francis, right? I look at Vatican II, there's still tensions. There are still some, but most of them go away. We're overreported, and so they're fewer in number and degree when you look at them. With Francis, you literally go to look up one error, and there are three that you didn't even see before. There are like 14 major issues with Amoris Laetitia, which came out in April of 2016. In February of 2016, you open, I think, your book on this. Mm-hmm. If everyone forgets about this one, he literally said, you could use condoms, or he said you could use artificial contraception in the case of Zika virus, which is wrong. It's an innate evil, intrinsic evil. And Greg Burke came out and said, yes, that is what he said yesterday. Actually, it's condoms. Things like that. That's
if I can kind of flesh that one out a little bit, because the original question was on pregnancy avoidance. So there was some actual ambiguity there. It was like, well, does he mean continence? Does he mean like AFP? Or does he mean like artificial contraceptive? Because the reporter's question was vague. And so right after it came out, yeah, you had like kind of the usual suspects saying, guys, why would you possibly think he means condoms here? Why would you possibly think he means artificial birth control? And there were all these articles written about why that's not what he means. And then the Vatican press office says, no, that's what he means. He means like the worst possible interpretation you could have taken was actually the right one here.
Right.
And for me, that was like, okay, that was kind of like a wake-up call. Like, there is not a way to just defend that. Like, again, like, I think there's a good aspect of saying, what's the best thing he could mean? But I think we're often, Matt Frad talks about this, like, there's a little bit of, like, gaslighting that can go on, where you're like, well, why would you possibly think he means the bad thing? And it's like, well, right. Context. Or like, well, this is what everyone's saying. There's, I think, a patristic commentary on John 8:48, when they tell Jesus that he's possessed and he's a Samaritan. And he really attacks the idea that he's possessed and shows that he's not. And he leaves the Samaritan claim kind of unanswered. And so the church fathers wrestled with, in what sense could we then call Jesus a Samaritan? Because so deeply ingrained is this idea, if someone accuses you of something evil, you have a duty, not out of pride, but out of like a respect for truth, to clarify that you're not saying the evil thing, that you're not saying the bad thing. So when like the front page of the Wall Street Journal and everything else is saying Pope backs civil unions for gay couples, if that's not what you're saying, you actually have a duty to clarify. If people are taking this route and saying, it sounds like you're saying X, and X is really bad, and you're not trying to say X, you actually need to clear that up. And that's why the Vatican has a press office, right? Like, it's...
Of course. I don't have press offices. And I'm doing this 3 or 4 days a week. I got to bite my tongue, man.
Yeah, and it's all on video. So you know what it's like. You know that it's possible to take a clip where it sounds much worse than what you actually mean. So you have to be very conscious about what am I saying and how am I saying it. Like, I speak differently privately because I can be a little looser. I don't have to be as precise. And yeah, like, that's just something you have to adjust to in the modern age. So to the extent that there are these ambiguities, it's good that you take, like, what would be a good interpretation of this? What might he mean? But to just pretend like, therefore, everyone's ridiculous for taking the more obvious, maybe worse interpretation. I think the Zika thing really hit home for me in a way where I was like, okay, I'm not going to do this. I don't want to keep saying, well, maybe he means this, maybe it was mistranslated, maybe the context is missing. Some of that stuff is true. Like, some of the scandals, I think, aren't actually as bad as they originally sound. Like, the who am I to judge in context, not as bad.
No one even talks about that one. Right. Yeah, I mean, that's like, because you could always say, well, I'm not God. It's like, who cares? Yeah. I mean, there are 50 bad ones that stick, like Zika, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's easy to focus on the ones that don't, and then act like those other 50, or whatever it is, aren't there. And so this was a turning point for me, where it's like, okay, somehow, as a Catholic who really believes in the papacy, I have to simultaneously say some of the things he's saying and doing shouldn't be defended, are indefensible in a pretty literal kind of way. And when you reject the perennial church's teaching on the use of contraception and very clearly go against what JP2 talks about with proportionalism, this is one of those ones where actually the more you dig into it, the worse it gets, like you just alluded to. Because in there, he talks about a possible conflict between the fifth and sixth commandment. And it's like, hold up. Like, now you're right. Saying maybe God contradicts himself, and that's why artificial contraception is okay. Like, that, the more you dig in, it's, yeah, like you said, it isn't like the context vindicates it. The context actually made this one worse.
Yeah.
So we have to acknowledge those things and say, no, no, the Ten Commandments don't contradict. No, the life of perfection isn't impossible logically. It's only impossible because of our fallen sinfulness and our bad use of free will, not because God has called us to the literally impossible.
Right.
So all of that stuff is like, okay, I got to defend the papacy and not defend indefensible things said by the Pope.
Let me tell a quick little narrative. When the February 2016 Zika virus condoms are okay thing happened, I was in the car going to CVS, back in California, picking up my daughter's anti-seizure medication. It was Chris Albert's show. And he came out and he was saying, and he'd admit this now. He came out and he was saying, oh, everyone took him out of context again. Once again, it was the gaslighting thing. And I know Chris a little behind the scenes. So I called up onto a show. I normally go through the drive through to pick up the medicine, but except I ran into the store so they would give me an extra time to talk. And I was like, talking to the producer, and I was like, hey, you're at a commercial. I know because I just ran in here. Can I talk to Chris? And he was like, no, he's busy now, blah, blah, blah. I was like, tell him it's Tim Gordon. This is serious. He's wrong in what he just said. The Vatican right now sent out American Greg Burke, who's no longer the mouthpiece. He came out and he said Pope Francis definitely meant artificial contraception, and he meant condoms. And I mean, I was like, this is so. I was like, dude, you're vitiating your point. You're defiling yourself. You don't do this. So I was like, would you just tell him this message is from Tim Gordon? And so he was like, yeah, I'll tell him. I'm like, he's probably not going to do it. So I go pick up the medicine, go back in my car. And the funny part was when I get back in my car, he sounded freaked out. I turned it back on, and it was the commercial break was ended, and I caught him mid-sentence, and he'd called up his good buddy, another Pope-splainer, and they're kind of reasoning it through, and they were reading the story. It had just broken. And it was like Providence or something, that the timing was really bad, and they were like, okay, how could this be? Okay, the Pope isn't right. They suddenly had downshifted to, okay, he didn't speak ex cathedra, so it's okay. It's okay. We don't know exactly what this means, but we were wrong before, which is good they were saying this, but...
Yeah.
They suddenly sounded how I'd been sounding, because I'd always been, because I mean, this stuff started almost immediately with Francis. It was non-exaggerated, non-scurrilous reportage of really bad stuff. I mean, remember the communist who gave him the cross on the hammer and sickle, and a National Catholic Register misreported what he said? They said he said something like, oh no. Well, I'll accept this anyway. And he literally said something affirmative. I was looking for that before this interview, couldn't even find it. But they had to go back and correct. He literally said, like, oh, cool, communism, or something like that. And not exactly that, don't quote me. But these things are so bountiful that it stretches the imagination. One strains the very moral imagination not to talk about it. Remember all of the Eugenio Scalfari interviews? You're talking about he's... You know, all of them except I think one are like a Christological issue. He's saying Christ might not be divine. This is it's larger than life. And for us Catholics, who both you and I are like, where are you going to go? You know, what bark are you going to leave to? Or Protestant? What a joke. Eastern Orthodox? Okay, I said this on my show the other day. A lot of more credible Catholics now that have been fed up with Francis for a long time are defending the dignity of the Eastern Orthodox position. I'm like, wait. You realize, Sankt Gallen, I want you to respond to this, Joe. Sankt Gallen Mafia Cardinal Walter Kasper, who for 30 years had been trying to get communion for the civilly divorced and remarried, got it, of course, under Francis. I mean, this is one of the main points that the St. Gallen Mafia gave us, Francis, was for communion for the civilly divorced and remarried. He got it under Francis. Guess where that plan comes from? The Eastern Orthodox. He literally took, they have divorce, they have contraception. I'm not going there. Like, what do you say to these people that now are like, I've been vindicated, I've been talking trash on Francis the whole time, this is why we need to go Eastern Orthodox? It's like, you missed the whole point, man.
It reminds me, after the Obergefell, like the gay marriage decision, there were a lot of people saying, oh, we're going to move to Canada. And it's like, guys, I don't know how much you know about Canada, but this is not going to solve that problem.
That's like, excellent.
So, yeah, I mean, look, it's a problem. This is something that we really need to pray for, because... yeah, what you're really saying is this is a serious problem, and even schism wouldn't solve it, which actually just maximizes how serious this is to grapple with. I mean, Peter's words, like, to whom will we go, Lord? You have the words of eternal life. Yeah, they ring true, and not in a triumphalistic way, because what preceded, or what was coupled with that, Jesus says, did I not call you 12, and one of you is a devil? And so, right in the midst of him saying, like, there's nowhere to go but the church, Jesus is like, don't forget there's corrupt clergy, and that's going to be with us forever because it's in the apostles. So right. That kind of thing is, like, we're kind of invited to grapple with it. We're not given an easy way out. We're not given an easy solution, like, oh, good, because this is the true church, there's not going to be a controversy, there's not going to be a scandal. There's the famous line, I think it's Hilaire Belloc, where he says, as a Catholic, I'm obliged to believe on account of faith in the papacy. But... a non-believer might be led to believe just on account of the fact that no such knavish institution would survive a fortnight without divine assistance. Like, everything is so badly run that this is in some strange way a proof that God is protecting it in the midst of this, because any secular institution would collapse with this kind of leadership, with this kind of, and again, not just Pope Francis, like 2000 years, it's different degrees, right? Like,
yeah,
you've got the pornocracy, you've got like popes openly like having kids out of wedlock, you've got war popes, you've got, you know, like all this stuff where it's like, you've got Honorius, who just kind of falls down on the job with the Three Chapters controversy and is later condemned as a heretic. Like, you've got all of these things where popes don't seem to live up to this, and yet still the papacy and the Catholic Church survives. And it seems like, oh, well, it just happened to do that. Like, guys, this is the longest lasting government in the world, secular or religious.
Right.
Like, that is actually miraculous. Like, that is actually astonishing, given the sort of things that would normally have led anything else to collapse with this kind of leadership.
That's what I say to fellow trads, by the way, when it's like, because I, you know, doing this, all this intensive research on the Vatican II documents, I'm like, oh, this is not what happens with Francis. I contrasted it a little bit earlier to what happens with Francis's magisterium. I'm like, oh, that, it doesn't say that. This is always, I've had this word added. I'd used for years the trad talking point, like 21 ecumenical councils, and this is the only one that's non-dogmatic. No, there are like three more. Oops. I mean, I'm a guy, I like to be accurate. That's what I do. I dot my I's, I cross my T's, so I go look this stuff up, and it's like, oh no, three of the other pastorals, the medieval councils were pastoral. Okay, this isn't, no, it doesn't say that. There is a word added. No, even this interpretation, it kind of stands, but it's not that bad. But I do, on the other hand, I do think that what was going on before, during, and after the council had bad intent at Vatican II. But what I say to them is like, look, this makes our faith even more amazing. The fact that literally, because there were a lot of bad guys at Vatican II when you look into what's happening. But the sacred constitutions were protected by the Holy Spirit, even against their authors. The authors are maybe many of them are trying to make this stuff bad. And yet the Holy Spirit protects this regime so much that you guys are missing the point. Like, the Vatican II documents turn out to be fine, not perfect, still with some weaponized ambiguity, but fine. It makes the point that you are just making, Joe, even stronger. What doesn't come out looking stronger, forget Vatican II. I know Archbishop Vigano and other of my friends have been out there saying Francis is tied at the hip to Vatican II. It's more Vatican I. That I'm not saying it's false. I'm just saying some of the dissenters of Vatican I are maybe worth a second look now. Bulgakov, some of his critiques of the pontificate of Vatican I. And by the way, Vatican I is also less problematic in many ways to critique, not because it's not dogmatic, but because it never really ended till the beginning of Vatican II, because the Franco-Prussian War broke out. Maybe we need a Vatican III, give a helpful gloss on Vatican I, and then we can have some of the important traditionalist issues talked about of Vatican II, like 1 + 2 = 3. How about a Vatican III?
So, yeah, I think, the Franco-Prussian War is a really important dimension to this, because Vatican I talks a lot about the papacy and didn't get a chance to talk about the proper role of things like the episcopacy. And then because it ends really abortively, in fact, I believe they didn't technically close it until Vatican II was about to open.
And yeah, that's like, right.
Oh, yeah, we never actually got to close this council because everything just kind of fell into chaos. But the result is that you did get kind of a lopsided ecclesiology, meaning you talk about the role of the papacy and leave everything else sort of in silence. That's going to give people the wrong idea. There's a really good essay on this by Louis Boyer, B-O-U-Y-E-R.
Y-E-R,
called The Catholic Church in Crisis from back in 1978. And he makes the same point. Like, yeah. He's saying, you know, what you see in the era between Vatican I and Vatican II are these bishops who are kind of lackeys, who view themselves as like middle management and just kind of vicars of the Pope. And the ones who are really ambitious just become kind of mouthpieces for the Vatican. And the Vatican seems only too content to have this. But this ends up being really destructive, because when it seems like the tide is shifting, when it seems like it might be cool to be a modernist, you get these people like the Archbishop of Quebec, who had denounced his predecessor as a modernist and gotten him kind of like thrown out, and then became Bishop of Quebec, and then ends up, once he sees like a shift in the wind, becoming a huge modernist himself. So there's a big thing there going on that, again, that's not really Vatican II to blame. That's a certain kind of warped ecclesiology that actually Vatican II was trying to address and confront. So you see much more the dignity of the episcopacy is really laid out in some ways for the first time at Vatican II. Like, to really explain, you know, there had been a question for a long time about even whether the episcopacy was a distinct order from the presbytery. So you'll find like medieval churches will have like the seven steps going up to the altar. And the highest one is presbyter. It's not, you know, bishop. And so it's like the idea that, well, is the bishop actually different in kind, or is it just a difference in degree? All of those really important questions about the episcopacy aren't really hammered out until Vatican II. Like you said, in the documents themselves, there's a lot there that I think is actually a good corrective to some of the chaos of Vatican I inadvertently produced on account of the Franco-Prussian War ending it abruptly. But if I could say a second thing, even this idea there's like craziness following the council, or there's ambiguity in the documents that is then used by bad people, that's not new with Vatican II either. You know, again, it's this idea that it's like, oh, Vatican II is uniquely bad in this regard. It's like, guys, go back to the First Council of Nicaea in 321. St. Basil the Great points this out. He says that it produced a storm at sea that was so fierce and wild as the tempest of the churches. Like, he just says, we're overthrown by one another. If our enemy is not the first to strike us, we're wounded by the comrade at our side. Like, he just talks about this chaos that's produced in the aftermath of the First Council of Nicaea, which we now look back on as being this amazing clarifying council. It condemned certain errors, but the language it used could be held either by Orthodox Catholics or by other heretics. Like, it didn't resolve every possible controversy in the church. And so you did have people weaponizing the language of Nicaea. Like, the whole history of, like, the conflict between Alexandria and Antioch. It's like, as soon as one of them gets kind of a doctrinal point clarified, they then swing to the other extreme, and they have to correct people in the other extreme. You know, that kind of thing happens throughout the early church. None of that is new. Like, the fact that people can use ambiguity in kind of the destructive negative way is just part of... yeah, how we get here as a church. And yet, throughout all of that chaos, throughout all that ambiguity, throughout all of the pain and the hardship, God is somehow still bringing orthodoxy intact through that. Like, in none of the councils that isn't saying, like, okay, here's a heretical teaching. Nope. Like, there's still a check where the Holy Spirit, he lets you go so far, but not any further.
Right. Right. It is certainly not a Vatican II show, because I really think it's highly limited, the conceptual connection between Vatican II and Francis. But I do want to push back on probably the one thing I'll push back on this show is, I'm with anybody that Gaines says the rad trad's like, no, Vatican II contains no errors. Its four sacred constitutions have less, well under half the weaponized ambiguity that you impute to it. It's amazing the Holy Spirit protected them, blah, blah, blah. But here's where I am still traditionalist. There is a sui, I say, there is a sui generis, unprecedented nature of the intent at the council. When you just used, Joe, weaponized ambiguity, you're talking about the fact that language can always be weaponized post hoc. Vatican II, as far as I can tell, is the only council where before and during they were having shadow council. I mean, maybe they were having shadow councils elsewise, but where all of the guys were all saying, hey, we know what we're going to do with these vague spots afterwards. It's the language is being weaponized before and during. I call it codified heteropraxy. My argument is this. They knew they couldn't transgress, make certain transgressions in the language. There are some bald spots. And as several of those bad guys were saying at the council, they were in the muscle. That's not just a rad trad talking point. They were running the council. They're having shadow council at the Greg, my old school. And they were, they knew what they're going to do with it later, to quote, who is that? I'm forgetting who that was that said that. I'll think of his name later in the show, and then I'll burst out with it like I have Tourette's. The point is, there's a corrective response to that. There are two competing forms of originalism. One's right, one's wrong. The right one is Scalia's textualism, the original public meaning of a ratified document, a constitutional document. The original public meaning is the real meaning of it, meaning it was ratified in 1963 or whatever, 1964. The words being used there must be defined as they were in 1963 or 1964, not as we would use them later. That's what original means. And public means, this is more important here, the public context. Even if there are bad private meanings being wired into codified heteropraxy, the public meaning is what gets ratified into the meaning. So the wrong form of originalism is called intentionalism, philosopher of language Stanley Fish. He would say, well, if an author or a sacred constitution's author has a secret meaning they want to wire into a text, which I do believe happened at Vatican II, then that's the real meaning. And it's like, no, you missed the whole idea of what a ratification convention is at a constitution, whether it's sacred or secular. It's the public meaning that matters. In constitutional circles, I'm also a jurisprude, we tend to argue more about what original public meaning is. In ecclesial circles, the argument should be more on the public meaning. So it's like, yeah, that, like I say, the conclusion is, if you take the right form of originalism, textualism, it's actually amazing that they were trying, the authors of the texts were trying to do bad things, I think, and they end up not being able to because of the Holy Spirit. Now, so that's just something I don't, that's the argument I'm writing for Tan that you might be interested in. But
I think I agree with the argument. I used to be a lawyer, so all of that, you're really barking up my tree here. Like, that is, I think it's not a coincidence that the really good Supreme Court justices are also Orthodox Catholics, because the same way that you should understand the Constitution, the same basic, you know, what is the public intended meaning of this, of these words, is the same way that you answer whether it's a liberal distortion of Vatican II or a Protestant distortion of what we mean by one holy Catholic and apostolic church or whatever the case may be. The same tools get you to Orthodox Catholicism and get you to good jurisprudence, I think. And I don't think it's a coincidence that right now all of the decent Supreme Court justices are Catholic. One of them, I guess, practicing Anglican, but baptized Catholic, still given good formation in this. But the second thing is, I don't think Vatican II is even unique in this regard. I'd have to go back and do a little bit of research because it's kind of a vague memory now, but I remember something involving Eutyches in the early church. I think maybe it wasn't like an actual like shadow council, maybe it wasn't an actual group of people meeting, but some of the people who were fathers at the one council were then kind of corrected at the next, that you have, because on some of these doctrinal disputes, again, this is where the Alexandria and Antioch thing, a lot of the Alexandrian theologians recognized the errors of Antioch and vice versa, and were not aware of their own errors. So it wasn't like they were like being intentionally nefarious, but their private interpretation of what they meant by the things they were saying was itself not perfectly orthodox in some of these cases, at least some of them.
Right.
And it isn't until kind of as you go down the road, you start to be like, oh, okay, whether or not this particular author meant this, this is true, but maybe not in the way he thought it was. But and then to kind of tie it back into Vatican II, like almost every bishop is signing on to these. You know, like you're having like enormous yes votes.
Right.
It's one thing to say there's some bad guys in the drafting room. It's
right.
Another thing to say all of the bishops are intending to affirm something heretical or are so dumb they can't understand heresy from orthodoxy. Like you would have to impute right. bad faith to like everyone at the council.
Well, and to Lefebvre himself, he literally signed all the documents. This is also what I'm always yelling at the walls, and everyone's like, "Well, forget about that." I'm like, he did too little at the council. He should have caucused against some of these points because there is ambiguity, weaponized ambiguity that remains. It's just not as bad as the Radtrad say. But he should have done more at the council and less after the council. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
When you're talking about Eutyches, that's Chalcedon.
Let me go back and look. I remember there were two back-to-back councils.
Yeah.
I remember Eutyches was somehow involved in it. But just like the way something had been worded the first time around, then proved problematic. I also, actually, you know what? The whole debate about persona in Latin became really controversial too, where there was an orthodox way of understanding it and then a heretical way of understanding it, because persona literally originally was like a mask that you speak through. So in affirming three personae, in the Trinity, it sounds like you're saying modalism. It sounds like you're saying right. one God speaks through three different masks.
Right.
And so there is an ambiguity there. Some of the people signing the document seem to believe the wrong form, seem to believe something more modalist. But what was actually affirmed is true, is accurate, despite some people misunderstanding what they're saying yes to.
Right. Right. It would be accidental ratification of the right position or something, whereas Vatican II is intentional codification of the wrong position or something like that. But the point is, the documents are the same. Really, I drew all this up only as a stark contrast, stark relief with Francis. So, I mean, since you did that interview and I heard and I was like, this guy's smart, let's get him on the show. And I'd heard your name before and I knew I'd happened to see that you'd published this book. I thought it was early fall, it was late summer or whatever. But then comes out and endorses gay civil unions. And guess what? Some people are doing it again, man. They're saying, no, there's going to be a clarifying context, just wait for it. No, that's unprecedented. There's never clarifying context. There's never, for any of these big ones, I don't think this is even the worst thing he said. But there's never clarifying context for the ones that I care about. They never go back and say anything meaningful about all the Scalfari interviews where he's saying Jesus might not be God. There's never anything like that. There's not going to be. And guess what? There's a line in there when he's talking about gay civil unions and he says, that's why I supported it. Mm-hmm. What he's talking about is when he was in Buenos Aires, he supported it then. So there's no context that's going to come out. Like, don't gaslight me. They're doing it again. Some people, not all, some.
Yeah. I mean, I've totally seen this cycle happen. And I think, you know, to give, I think you called them Pope splinters before, to give people their due, like, yeah, there is a sense in which this is a pastiche. It's kind of Frankenstein together. They're taking different things he said and kind of weaving them to make it sound a little more extreme than what he actually said. Like, there's the line where he says that homosexuals have a right to a family. And out of context, it sounds like he's endorsing gay marriage. And he's not. And in the proper context, it's clear he's talking about people getting kicked out of their family.
Yes.
That part, quickly clarified, it's very clear from going back that that's not what he was saying. Someone in the Vatican, I think you've called it deep church before, like someone in the Vatican Curia or wherever, is giving private interview footage to this person to put together in a more extreme, like weather balloon kind of way, to see like, what would happen if we said this. Like, I think there's clearly some element of bad faith somewhere behind the scenes. But that doesn't matter, because the other thing is just kind of clear as day with the endorsement of the civil union law. And here again, it was like, oh, well, conviviality is maybe a more literal translation. And then you have the Argentine bishop saying, no, like, that's just a term we use for the civil unions. Like, it doesn't matter if literally, you know, you might interpret it in a different way. Actually, I have an example of this. I used to live in Italy, and early on, I was at a restaurant on the Amalfi Coast, and I was in seminary at the time. I was with a bunch of other seminarians, and we were in clerics. And so the cook comes out of the kitchen, wants to talk to us about Catholicism, and he's like, "Well, it's good for a man to love another man, but like the way it was so unclear to me, at least as like an English speaker trying to dabble in Italian, that originally, like in the context, I was so mystified. I thought he was talking about just like brotherly love." And then yeah, like it's good. And then cool. It quickly became clear from his response, like, but the church says this is wrong. But like, oh no, homosexuality. I see what you're saying. Like, so I get like trying to parse apart like another language. You can say, well, literally, there's a way you could understand this correctly, but contextually in the language, no one's going to make that mistake.
So when an Argentine
says, idiomatically, exactly. Yeah. When an Argentine says, this is what we mean. I trust that over like someone Google translating their way through and saying, well, maybe.
Right.
But moreover, like you said, the context here, he alludes back to his role as Bishop of Buenos Aires. So I think if you were going to defend this kind of statement, the only way you could do it, there's the 2003 CDF document that talks about why it's not okay to endorse civil unions, why it's not okay to like push for this. But it includes this little proviso in paragraph 10 that when it is the law of the land, you can push for is like a less awful option as a proposal to limit the harm done. Mm-hmm. And I actually think, at least contextually, part of what he was doing at the time is they were pushing for gay marriage and he was trying to get them to take a lesser option. But he does himself no favors when he says they need legal protection, because then he's just endorsing the very thing the CDF says you can't endorse. Like, then he's just saying, like, no, this isn't just like a lesser option. It's actually a good in some sense. Because giving legal protection to these unions that shouldn't have legal protection. You know what I'm saying? Like, there is a way someone could say, in the same way, like the abortion example is given in Evangelium Vitae, and it's cited by the CDF. Like, if you're in a country that has like radical abortion laws, and you can get like a heartbeat bill, like no abortions after there's a heartbeat, that's great. You should push for it. And you shouldn't oppose it just because it doesn't outlaw all abortions. On the other hand, if you're like, no, this is what the abortion law ought to look like, that would be a huge problem, because then you're not pro-life. So you can take it as like the best possible answer, you know?
Right.
But so the CDF is clearly, if you're going to do that, you need to accompany that by an absolute personal opposition that is made public, that you don't think this is actually like, that you're not saying heartbeat bill is where abortion should be. Likewise, civil unions, you have to accompany your advocacy for civil unions as the least bad option with a very clear statement that you're not saying civil unions are good, just that they're less bad than the alternative available, you know, from a political prudence perspective.
With a very clear statement, with a very clear context, a locus in quo you're springing from, that is worse than what you're advocating. Whereas when Pope Francis just pitches it, like, the Platonic form of gay civil unions, it should be advocated for. That just means, well, we what about a place like pre-America Obergefell? Like, we didn't have that federally. He'd be upping the bar rather than lowering the bar, which is kind of what I said to Trent Horn, who I like, when he was making the, I'd say, false analogy to Thomas, advocating for, like, prostitution does not need to be illegal. He says not all vices need to be proscribed, not all virtues need to be mandated. He says this very clearly in the Summa. Even Aristotle kind of comes to this in Book 5 of the Nicomachean Ethics. So that's not Thomas saying there's an affirmative right, like a use, I-U-S, to prostitution. Of course there can't be. It's grave matter. It's a mortal sin.
The CDF also makes this distinction themselves, by the way. Those who would move from tolerance to the legitimization of specific rights for cohabitating homosexual persons need to be reminded that the approval or legalization of evil is something far different from the toleration of evil. Like, having a de facto situation of cohabitation is acceptable on Aquinas prostitution grounds. Like, sometimes the attempt to outlaw vice creates vices. Like, sometimes the attempt, you know, prohibition. Like, drunkenness is bad, but prohibition actually made the problem worse rather than better. So you don't have to say drunkenness good. But if you started giving like tax incentives for people getting drunk, now you're actually encouraging evil. Right. Now you're materially or formally cooperating with it. And so the CDF makes that distinction. And it very explicitly says that it would be formal cooperation if you enact or apply gravely unjust laws. And they include this specifically with homosexual right. unions. That right. it is one thing to say these two guys live together in a gay relationship. There's no way of trying to regulate that legally that wouldn't become like a police state. To say right. like, oh, these two roommates live together. We don't know what's going on between them. No, you leave it alone.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean you have to give them a tax incentive if they say they're a couple, because then you're just encouraging evil qua evil.
Precisely. These two guys live together in a gay way, or like they live together as college roommates. Yeah, the state doesn't have to delve into every college roommate situation. Like, are you guys gang each other or whatever? Like, that's not the affirmative duty of the state. And I didn't know CDF made that distinction. Yeah. So that sounds like you really had that memorized. Very, very impressive, Joe. So let's do this. I think we agree about number 266 here, this Pope. I can't think of a time. Yes, we've had more papal misbehaviors, siring children in the Vatican than that. I can't think of a time when a Pope, because I don't think it exists, has ever challenged true Christian teaching in a true way, not ex cathedra, so it's not really a direct challenge to Vatican I. Ever before in the history of the pontificate. So what do we do? What is your book advocate
for? Well, I think Honorius and John the 22nd would be the two counterexamples I would give of Honorius seeming to give a green light to a heretical position in terms of monothelitism.
Right.
And John the 22nd, not John the 23rd, John the 22nd with the denial that the saints enjoyed the beatific vision immediately upon death. But right. to his credit, after the theologians at the University of Paris called him out and said, hey, that's actually heretical. He walked it back and said, oh, I think I was wrong about this.
I know. Chris Plantz pointed that out to me. Yeah.
Yeah. So and then quickly it was like clarified dogmatically by his successor. So, you know, like that sort of thing where the Pope was creating a big problem there. And there he was just acting seemingly out of ignorance. Likewise with Honorius, I think he doesn't understand the full dimensions of what's going on. So they give him like a formulation, again, with the weaponized ambiguities. They give him a formulation that to Western ears sounds totally fine, but is actually an attempt to kind of promote this this heretical doctrine in the East. And he's like, yeah, that's good. And then quickly they find out that this is not good, that this is being used in a really heretical way. And then you end up with like the Robert Council, and you get the Pope stepping in and very clearly saying, no, this is wrong. No, you can't go this way. And so it actually ends up being a papal vindication, but it is by Honorius's successor, not by Honorius himself.
But even then, think of how much we hear about, especially Honorius, but also John the 22nd. And people will say in defense of Francis, like, look, it's not wholly unprecedented. That's with one issue, man. Think of what this does to our sense of proportion, okay, Joe? That's with one issue. Francis is bad on... There are like 14 major issues in Amoris Laetitia. There are major issues in Laudato Si. There's major issues we barely even talked about in Querida Amazonia. There are major issues in the new encyclical. We haven't even gone through most of them. His Wednesday audiences, Francis's, are all that one issue we talk about Honorius times like a million, and we don't even get to talk about even the Francis detractors that get called fatuous. Sometimes it's been me. Don't even get to talk about all of them. He said Jesus didn't do miracles, right? He said the real miracles people are sharing. That was not just a mistranslation. All of the Scalfari interviews. So I would say that as a distinction of degree, not kind, he is still there. He had Pope Honorius as one big thing we talk about nonstop, blah, 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 blah. Honorius, Honorius, Honorius. Except he's had it with 50 issues or something, 45 issues, whatever it is. Go through and actually look them up. You know, some of them are less doctrinally unsound. Some are just like, you just sound like you don't like Christians when you're like, you know, do we have to reproduce like rabbits? No, be responsible. And then that combined with the February 2016 thing, it's like he is saying contraception or whatever. Or all of the Christological stuff he said to Scalfari. That's unprecedented as a distinction of degree.
I think there are a couple things that are probably going on there, and I'm totally speculating here. But I mention this because I think there's a broader question than Pope Francis here, because I'm looking kind of further down the road. Like, I'm looking at what are the successors of Francis going to be like.
Okay.
We have kind of the era of the celebrity pope coupled with, like, global communications in a way we didn't before. I mean, when you compare the number of pages we have of Pope Francis or of Benedict or of JP2 compared to all of their successors, it's not even close, right? Like, when you start to say, how many quoted words do we have of this, that, or the other pope? There are some popes where, like, it's literally, like, zero words. We have no idea what he was like. We have no idea what his preaching was like, because there wasn't a website that was compiling it and disseminating it to the world. And this meant that when Pope spoke, there was a high level of intentionality, and so there was a great deal of clarity, because they were being very precise, very intentional. They're writing letters, or they're you know, writing encyclicals, or they're doing whatever, and there's a great deal of intentionality, rather. Off-the-cuff stuff. I mean, I know you're pointing out some of the problems, even in kind of encyclicals, even in the ordinary magisterium. And I think that's worth taking seriously. But a lot of the most extreme things are actually coming in either Wednesday audiences, or especially, like, plain interviews, or unsourced, unrecorded interviews, like the Scafari thing, where it's like he's an atheist who's an octogenarian who's remembering these things without having taken any notes. And so there's a huge question mark about even how seriously do we take any of this stuff. But then, like, the Vatican posts one of his interviews on the Vatican website, you know, that sort of thing. Like, we're in an age where, like, everything the Pope says, even off the cuff, is, like, national news. And I think we're going to have to really come to some real conclusions about what do we take seriously and what is, like, not even at the level of ordinary magisterium, where it's just somebody talking kind of off the cuff. A priest friend of mine gives the example of a Supreme Court justice. And a Supreme Court justice, you know, when he's writing the majority opinion, or she, whatever, the words that they're saying in the holding are literally law. Like, they're writing law word by word. But when they're writing a dissent, or when they're giving a talk, or when they're having tea with you and they're just explaining their vision of the law, or when they write a book, or when they, you know, mumble something in their sleep, those things aren't law. Like, it's not even a difference in degree. Like, those things just aren't law. And if we care about them, it's only because, well, this person, given kind of who they are, probably has, like, a good insight into the law, right? Like, we will read an interview a Supreme Court justice gives, but we understand that's different, you know, than a Supreme Court opinion. So likewise, like, as popes have more and more and more and more stuff written in less formal contexts, I think we're going to have to really take seriously what is part of the magisterial teaching and what's connected to the office, and what is just the individual kind of speaking off the cuff.
But there's a problem there I see potentially too. That presupposes that 265 popes before Francis, and really Benedict, and like you said, JP2, lived kind of in the information age, especially Benedict. I don't think 265 out of the first 266 popes had anything approaching Francis's personal opinion of the church. Another way, I think that's unfair to those guys. Another way to say it is this: why all of the personal opinions of Francis that get published, and a lot of them get published for the reason you just enumerated, why are all of them anathema to the faith? Okay, they're not ex cathedra, they're non-dogmatic, but why are all of them lockstep as private opinions with, yeah, secular humanists who hate the church, who hate Catholics that really believe the dogmas of the faith, the rigids? Why are they all secular humanists when it comes to favoring artificial contraception? Why are they pretty much all with the world on gay stuff, gay civil unions? Why are they pretty much all with the world on you know, historicizing Christ and making him seem like just a guy? Why are they all against the church? That question will be the a judgment of history more than anything. But except I do think that we trivialize, and neither you nor I are trying to trivialize this stuff. We're looking at it full on. Everyone stay Catholic, you and I say. Don't leave the bark, because atheism's the only position more ridiculous than becoming an Orthodox or a Protestant. And yes, I'm still being a bit triumphalistic when it's like, there's nowhere else to go, like Peter says. But having said all that, Francis is a real problem for you and I and everyone else that cares about the faith. Not necessarily a damning problem. I'm not saying he makes Vatican I wrong, because I don't think he does. I haven't committed to that at all. But he's a real challenge, and he necessitates Vatican III from the perspective of, we need that gloss that we didn't get because of the hurried non-closure of Vatican I. I think that's a real thing, and I think it's unfair to, like, Benedict, or let's say he gets a half decent predecessor, or no, whatever successor. It is. Yeah. Then that would be, I don't think it's fair to assume of a pontiff that just because he lived in the information age, yes, the person will be imperfect, no one's perfect but Jesus, that there are going to be these like 50 or so gaffes. I don't think just because now the Wednesday audiences are posted that, we must assume that the first 265 popes were probably saying Jesus didn't really do miracles in their Wednesday audiences, and it's just a lack of a paucity of information. I don't think that's fair to any of those first guys, even the ones who are siring kids in the Vatican. I don't think anyone else thought that aside from him. There is a sense in which he is sui generis. Same as what I said about, I think Vatican II is still sui generis, just not in the way that the Radtrads believe, in a way that's salvageable. I think he's sui generis bad, but not in a way that should make anyone leave the church. I'll give you the closing word, because we got
to okay. Well, here. Yeah,
I
think
you respond to that.
Yeah, I think you're making a really good distinction that you're going to have a certain level of imprecision when you have an enormous quantity of off the cuff material. But that's going to be more like Benedict saying that politicians who vote for abortion are excommunicated, when he actually meant to say should be refused communion. And he speaks off the cuff on the way to Mexico or somewhere in Latin America, and he says this, and then the Vatican Press Office quickly clarifies canonically. He didn't mean what he said. It was a simple mistake. That's the kind of thing we would expect to find. Like,
sure.
Some technical thing you get wrong.
Perfect.
That's pretty different from the kind of stuff we're dealing with right now. And I think everyone knows that. And anyone saying they don't know that, like, it is not just laying their cards on the table. There are a few medieval popes where there are big question marks. Their enemies accused him of doing things like toasting to the devil and, you know, all that stuff. You never know what to believe in any of that stuff when it's written by people who hate them. And all that stuff. So there might have been like a bad handful, but definitely you're not going to say 265 were seriously doubting these kind of fundamentals of the faith, or had such a poor grasp of it themselves that they were saying things that you would kind of grit your teeth at if a parish priest said it. You know, like those kind of things. I think it's fair to say there are some unique problems we've never grappled with. My point is just like, we don't know that that's going to stop here. And so there's a real silver lining, and I mean this in a genuinely hopeful way. One of the problems that I fell into, I think a lot of people fell into under JP2 and Benedict, is taking a sort of funhouse mirror vision of the church that again, you connect it to Vatican I. It's not Vatican I's fault, but it's a certain interpretation of Vatican I that says basically the Pope is the church, and everybody else is just like the Pope's intermediaries and functionaries. That's not what Jesus sets up. Like, when he makes Peter the head of the apostles, he's the head of apostles, not just the head of, like, Peter and his peons. Like, the apostles have a legitimate authority unto themselves. In Luke 22, like, Jesus entrusts all of the apostles with a certain servant leadership of the church, and then gives Peter a role in relation to that. So often, we're losing things like the legitimate role of the bishop, because, look, for decades, a lot of the bishops in this country and around the world were kind of crummy. And the Pope was pretty good. And so it's easy to say, ignore the bishop, just focus on the Pope. Well, now we see, like, okay, you can't really do that. Like, it's good that bishops are coming out and clarifying that civil unions are a no-go. Like, it's good that, like, the Bishop of Providence is saying, yeah, that's not what we believe as Catholics. That's actually a legitimate role where the bishops are acting as successors of the apostles. They're not just middlemen for the Pope. And it was bad when the shoe was on the other foot and we kind of acted like they were. Because that wasn't what Christ established, even if it was more convenient than what he actually established. You know, like, even if it was more convenient in the moment, the principle is, like, these are the successors of the apostles, however unworthy they may be, just as the Pope is the successor of St. Peter as the head of the apostles, however unworthy he may be. So if there's one thing we should be taking away from this positively, it isn't just don't bend over backwards and deny the truth. Right. Like, you know, the two horns are, you don't want to go in a direction that's contrary to charity, but you also don't want to go in a direction that's contrary to truth. Like, both of those are sinful. You have to live in that media. Like, to be able right. to say, I wish the best for him. I hope he means this, but I'm not going to pretend that therefore he definitely meant this, because that's everyone sees through that, right? And so the good thing is, living in that media, there's a real sense of the need for the renewal of the legitimate role of the bishops, as that the Pope isn't just the oracle from on high, right? Like, that's not what papal infallibility is all about. That's not the structure of the church. And I think we have a real opportunity to correct some sort of distorted understandings of the papacy and of ecclesiology now, that hopefully will end up with a church that's stronger and healthier in the long run.
That's well said. That's very, very well said. I like that a lot. And everyone should go pick up this book, Pope Peter, Joe Heschmeyer. This has been genuinely illuminating, and I think people are really, really going to connect with this show once we air it. I guess it's probably going to be aired for the first time ever. I really have a backlog of shows. It'll probably be aired after the election, maybe Monday of election week, but I have a lot of pre-election interviews, because I do a handful of, you know, secular conservative things as well, because it's so important what's going to happen to Americans and the world during and after this election. But I'm actually very eager to air this interview. I think people are really going to find it comforting, the way you were talking and we were able to dialogue together. So the book is Pope Peter, Joe Heschmeyer. This has been a great conversation, and I really appreciate your time coming on.
I really enjoyed coming on. It was great talking to you and just being able to kind of share heart to heart about these issues.
Make good distinctions, which is something that the simple-minded don't do. I didn't know you were a lawyer before this, but it good lawyers make good distinctions. Bad lawyers don't make them, and kind of everyone else, besides maybe philosophers, don't make distinctions. The truth inheres in making a distinction within a distinction within a distinction within a distinction, and that's why you're good to talk to. Really, really handy with the distinction. So thanks for your time, man.
Oh yeah, my pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Cool. All right, everyone, hang on to your hats. I don't know exactly if this is airing when we have a decision. That's unlikely on the election. God bless America. Deus vult. God bless the world. We need it. God bless the pontificate. Everyone, hang tough. Like this channel. Subscribe. You know, click the bell. See to our Patreon accounts, because we're really getting cracked down on from YouTube. It's really scary. The world's in a weird place now. You know, the church and the world both need our prayers. Deus vult, everyone. God bless. Peace.